Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gap Fest Chef Boyardee edition. It's Wednesday, July 6th, 2022. On today's show, the Black Phone comes to us from Blumhouse, the celebrated indie horror shop. In this one, a creepy masked man has been snatching kids off the streets of a Colorado suburb. But has the so-called grabber met his match in Finney, the soulful innocent now entrapped in his basement? And then Hulu brings us the TV show The Bear, about a Chicago working-class kid who's on his way to Michelin star glory when he returns home to run his family's neighborhood slop joint. It stars Jeremy Allen White as Carmine, the no longer prodigal son. And finally, Chef Boyardee in a pre-made pie crust. Disgusting food videos are going viral. We will discuss. Joining me today is Jamelle Bouie, Slate alumnus and, of course, columnist for the New York Times. Hey, Jamelle, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Always just superb to have you. And Dana Stevens is the film critic for Slate.com. Hey, Dana.
Hey, hey.
Wow.
Does that sound wan?
that was on brand Dana plus a lot of extra. That's like a lot of wan. You okay?
I actually don't even feel wan about our topics this week. I'm really excited to jump into the conversation. I don't know. I'm just a bad greeter. I'm sorry. I'm waking up.
No, you're a terrific one. You went hard on July 4th as you do every year, right?
Yeah, you know me. It's just a patriotism bender around here.
All right. Well, let's dig in. The Black Phone, it's a small, nicely observed indie horror pick. The Grabber, so-called Grabber, is a child snatcher at loose in a small mountain town. His mini crime spree has disappeared about a half a dozen kids and, of course, cast a pall over, well, you know, everything, of course. Young Finney is a sweet, soulful boy, target of bullies, one of whom is his own broken-down father, a widower drunk and the ultimate moral coward, a physical abuser of his own children. Genre-wise, the inevitable happens. Finney is the latest kid to be snatched, but what if it's this kid with the aid of the mysterious voices calling him on a seemingly disconnected black phone is the one that got away? The film stars Mason Thames, T-H-A-M-E-S, I'm not sure, but what a wonderful name, as Finney, Madeline McGraw as his younger sister, whose dreams may actually be clairvoyant insights into the grabber's whereabouts and M.O., and Ethan Hawke as the masked perpetrator himself. All right, let's listen to a clip. In the clip, we're going to hear the grabber, played by Hawke. He's talking to Finney, who he now has locked in his soundproof basement. I should say also throughout most of the movie, the grabber's wearing a series of incredibly spooky masks. Let's listen to the clip.
I know you're scared and you want to go home. I'll take you home soon. Sister, I gotta be upstairs for a while. Something's come up.
What?
Never mind what.
Someone's coming. I'll scream. If someone's upstairs, they'll hear me.
With the door shut, no one can hear anything down here. I soundproofed it myself. So shout if you like. You won't bother anyone.
If you try to touch me, I'll scratch your face. And whoever's coming will see and ask why.
This face?
Of course, he's indicating that creepy, creepy mask. Dana, you're the film critic. I'll start with you. This comes to us from, it's directed and co-written by Scott Derrickson. He directed a Doctor Strange movie, but also he's done indie horror stuff. What'd you make of this offering?
I mean, I did not expect to like this movie that much, largely because of the advertising campaign, which has been ubiquitous over the past few weeks on buses and so forth. And it's just this big poster of the mask that you just referred to, admittedly a very creepy mask, which I did not realize until reading notes, some prep for this show, was designed by Tom Savini, the great gore master of many zombie movies past. It's a very effective mask, but the advertising campaign indicates that it's going to be all about Ethan Hawke's villain. And I was just afraid, for one thing, that it would have sort of Joker vibes, you know, that it would be a self-indulgent performance, that we would just have to witness a lot of gore in order to watch Ethan Hawke kind of try to outact himself and be a villain, which he rarely is. In fact, this movie is scarcely about that character at all. He's a very effective, scary guy, as you can hear in that scene. He uses his voice in particular, which is a not that gravelly voice, but sort of a high-pitched one really effectively. But it really is a movie all about the kid and about kids in general, about that boy, the main character, about, well, we can get into this and decide how much we're going to spoil, but about other boys who were earlier kidnapped by the grabber, and about the little girl who is the kidnapped boy's younger sister and is trying to help find him. And I thought it was such an effective movie about childhood. In fact, I sent my daughter, my 16-year-old daughter, to see the movie with her friends after seeing it, because I thought, if I had seen this as a teenager, you know, if you're a teenager that can handle some horror, I would have really, really loved it, because it really is, in a way, about, you know, the younger generation outwitting the older and kind of figuring the way out of a tough situation. It's also very short, which I really, really appreciated. Sort of small and just like a dirty, gritty horror movie of this style that I grew up watching and that I love.
All right. Well, Jamel, Dana was, it's fair to say, I think, way more than pleasantly surprised by this movie. What about you?
You know, I didn't go into the movie with any particular expectations, and there were things about it that I really did enjoy. But when I finished it, I was sort of, I had said to my friend who I saw it with, I said that it was weird, and not weird in sort of like it's crazy and it's, you know, not weird in that sense, but weird in that like it felt just sort of totally off to me, that like there is this real dazed and confused energy throughout. And there's even, I mean, my personal favorite sequence in the movie involves some sort of like tough teenager who, like, you know, beats the crap out of someone who interrupts him getting a high score in a pinball game. And so sort of like all that dazed and confused 70s childhood stuff I thought was really effective. And then when it became a kind of horror thriller, I did not find that as effective. And the two of them juxtaposed together, I just thought was odd. And I'm not sure that it works necessarily.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I'll break the tie here by saying I thought it was terrific. And I think it's interesting that we've kind of fastened on different parts of it, because to me, it's the central relationship is between the two siblings, Finney and his younger sister, Gwen, I think her name is. That kid is, they're both beautifully portrayed as sensitive kids and trapped in an abusive household for whom school ought to be an escape from this hothouse of like violence and recrimination presided over by their father, but actually just turns out to have all the horrible psychodynamics of bullying. And then those psychodynamics are intensified to the 100,000th degree in the basement situation. And so you've been set up to really identify with Finney, the potential victim, to along with like this Odysseus-like pang for his reunion with his sister, his one soulmate, his real rock in the world. And also what he has to do in order to potentially escape requires him becoming the kind of person who hasn't yet learned how to stand up to the bully. I mean, it's a movie about bullying that actually took the time to show you what amity and real love and healthy psychology look like when they occur between two people in a truly reciprocal relationship. I thought it was just weirdly well done. And Jamel, it's interesting. I thought in some ways it failed as a genre movie, but succeeded as a almost as a different kind of movie. It's based on a short story and it feels like it is, which is a flaw. We're used to, I think, movies being bulked out often quite creatively in the second act, right? This is a movie with classic second act problems. The setup is beautiful. These people become very real to you very quickly. I actually thought the resolution was quite good, though there were moments when I was afraid it was going to be pat or trite, and it just kind of delivered for me. And in between, it's thin. Like, that's where the gruel gets thinnest, no doubt about it. Dana, you acknowledge that, right? Like all of the kind of intermediary tasks that bulk out a classic second act, where you try and fail, try and fail, try and fail, but in the course of it, cumulatively grow, and you become the hero who can succeed in the third act. Like, that doesn't exactly happen here, but you and I think, perceive this as a virtue.
I mean, I guess that's true, but I couldn't get into it without spoiling, but I can actually think of several examples that counter that. I mean,
you're right.
But to be cryptic about it, the calls that come in on the black phone, right, slowly build the kid's ability to try to figure a way out of his situation.
True.
And yeah, I would agree that the middle is maybe somewhat underwritten, but I think we just see, for this podcast and just in general as a critic, I see so many things that are overwritten and overdetermined. And this made me think of Stranger Things a lot too, the TV show, which I don't follow, but we did talk about the first season of on this show. And my first thought on coming out of this movie was, it sort of got the Stranger Things remit done in under 2 hours instead of, you know, 4 seasons or whatever we're into with that show now. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is less nostalgic than Stranger Things. It's, from what I know of that show, darker and grittier. And the vision of the 70s that Derrickson delivers is not at all a sort of bathed in a licorice pizza kind of glow about the 70s. In fact, it makes it look, outside of the serial killer part, like a dangerous time to be alive. I thought some of the early stuff about the school fights, the after school fights where, you know, kids gather to watch one kid beat another up, were really dark, because the world really that they presuppose is still the world that we live in, you know, even outside of the basement of this killer. And that might, again, be true to the world that it takes place in. It's not an after school special, you know.
No.
I don't know. The more we talk about it, the more I like this movie. And part of what I like about it is that very slightness, you know, that I guess could be seen as a fault. I remember at a certain moment toward the climax of the movie, when the action is starting to heat up, thinking, if this movie takes 20 more minutes to end, I'll kind of like it. But if it can get it done in 10 minutes, I'm going to love it. And it got it done in about 8 minutes after I had that thought, you know, and there's something about that compactness that really impressed me.
I agree with that. Like, I think the compactness of the movie really works in its favor. I don't have a problem with the fact that it is somewhat shaggy in the beginning. Like, again, that's the stuff I like the most. I don't know. I think I would have preferred a movie that were either much more of the childhood movie, 70s childhood, brutal. I mean, you, Dana, you mentioned those fights, but like, those fights these weren't just like kids pushing each other. Like, kids were beating the shit out of each other, in a really kind of striking way. If there were sort of more of that and almost less of the, you know, the captivity at the hands of Ethan Hawke, I think I would have preferred the movie a bit more. I think I would have preferred the movie a bit more if the relationship between Finney and his sister, which is pretty, it's strong and fleshed out, like, amounted more to anything in terms of the resolution of the film. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think there's something to be said for plot and story elements that don't sort of tie tightly together with everything. But also, for a movie as compact as it is, it was sort of like strange to feel at the end that, oh, we had this entire aspect of the characters in the story that seemingly is just there for, you know, the edification of the characters themselves, which, again, is fine. But it doesn't really amount to much in terms of the dilemma for Finney.
Yeah, no. You've identified something about the movie. We can't talk about it more without spoiling. That's really true. Like, there's like a kind of non-payout. Let's talk a little bit about Ethan Hawke in this movie. He's had this interesting late career, mid to late career renaissance. He's meant to be really like maximally sinister in this film. What'd you make of him as this kind of a malevolent figure?
I thought he was great. You mentioned earlier that he used his voice and sort of pitched his voice up, and I thought that was exactly the right approach. Like, he seems to play this character as like a weird, sad guy, not in a way that engenders sympathy, but in the way mm-hmm. that's just sort of like, if you saw him on the street, you just go, you'd cross the street. Like, I don't want to be near that dude. And I thought that was great. He has a line reading at some point where he, I think it may have been the one we used, where he's like, you know, everything's messed up, I have to go upstairs. That I thought was just hilarious and terrific, and kind of got exactly the essence of the character. So I thought Ethan Hawke was great. I think this, like, Ethan Hawke-essence has been terrific. I've really enjoyed seeing him in all sorts of stuff. So I'm here for him.
Brilliant. Okay, Jamel, one more very quickly, as by way of going around the table. Friend of you says, what, should I go see it or not? Yes or no? What are you doing?
Oh, that's tough. I would say yes, and I'm thinking about the personal review I gave it, and I may need to, like, nudge it up just a bit. I would say yes, but, like, go on, like, an afternoon when you're paying cheaper movie ticket prices.
There you go. Perfect. Dana, you and I are pretty hearty thumbs up, yes?
Yeah, I mean, I sent my daughter to see it about 2 hours after I saw it. You know, not urgently saying this is something you absolutely must do, but she was in the mood to see a movie. I said, hey, how about a sort of scary, gritty Stranger Things? And, you know, she was into it. Yeah, I would definitely send people to see it. Although if you're some kind of horror connoisseur, you might find it a little bit underbaked.
I thought it was really relative to my expectations. I thought it was a gem. For what it's worth, check it out. It's the
good
Black
child
Phone.
Acting too. As somebody who was just on this very show mean to a child actor only weeks ago, I think both the boy and the girl who plays his little sister are excellent, and they're really well written child characters that aren't generic imperiled infants.
I agree.
Excellent. I love it when we have intelligent fence sitting of a kind on the show. It allows our listeners, I think, to email in and not just one way or the other. All right, the Black Phone, check it out. Let's move on.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on all your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
All right, before we go any further, this is typically in our show where we discuss business. Dana, what do we got?
Steve, now that we have capped entries for the Summer Strut edition, we cannot take any more songs. You cannot imagine how many songs we got, and we're very grateful for them. But that leaves us with only one item of business this week, which is to tell you about today's Slate Plus segment. This week, a listener named Andrew wrote in with a really smart, really interesting question about how we perceive the relationship between politics and culture on our show and just in general in our world. Are politics upstream of culture? Is culture upstream of politics? What kind of feedback loop do they produce with each other? And how do you really extricate the two? It was a really well-phrased question, better than I just phrased it in my summary. We will read that out loud in our Slate Plus segment and attempt to answer it. If you're a Slate Plus member, you can, of course, look forward to that conversation at the end of this show. And if you're not a Slate Plus member, you can sign up today at slate.com/culture plus. As you know, if you're a Slate Plus member, you get ad-free podcasts. You get bonus content like the segment I just described, and lots of other shows have those too. You get unlimited access to all of the great writing on Slate, so you will never hit a paywall if you're a Slate Plus member. And most important of all, you support us, our magazine, our work, the work of all our wonderful colleagues, and the journalism they do. These memberships matter a lot for Slate, so please sign up today at slate.com/culture plus. Once more, that's slate.com/culture plus. Okay, Steve, back to the show.
All right, well, The Bear, it's on Hulu. It's a TV show with a setup that will not seem especially fresh. A working-class Italian kid makes good in the world of haute cuisine. He was, I think, at 11 Madison, they say, at one point, a sous chef. That's as haute as it gets, as far as I understand it. Only to return home and take over the family greasy spoon. Yada, yada, right? But The Bear is being praised as a wildly fun and fresh take on the inner dynamics, familial and surrogate familial, that run through such an enterprise as a rich and funny portrait of its host city, Chicago. The show comes from the mind of Christopher Storer, known for production credits on Raimi and Eighth Grade. It stars Jeremy Allen White as Carmine, Eben Moss Bacharach as his foul-mouthed, no-bullshit, all-bullshit cousin, and Io Itabiri as Sydney, who's coming in to help tighten the ship. In the clip, you're going to hear Carmine. He's trying to navigate his new role as restaurant owner and head chef, but his kitchen staff seems, to put it mildly, a little resistant to the new boss. Let's listen.
Tina.
Carmen.
Ibrahim.
Where is the beef?
It's in the oven. Tina, can you start a new jar in there for me, please, chef?
I need my fennel first, chef.
Carmen.
Ibrahim.
I need my beef. Then I do onion. Then I do potatoes. We have a system.
But you could punch him, blanch him, freeze him, fry him before the beef, right?
Don't mess up our place.
I'm not messing anything up. Chef, no, please, please do not touch that. This is the one time you listen to me. Please do not touch that. That's been going for 12 hours, okay?
That's my pot, Jeff. Everybody knows.
That's her pot.
All right, use another pot, please, chef, all right?
Corner!
Hey, Marcus, I need a double order of bread today, okay, chef?
Come on, Carmen, I've been telling you for the past 2 weeks the mix was fucking. I gotta do all this by hand. Plus, Tina keeps messing with the temperature and it's fucking on my ride. Tina, I know you speak English.
Listen, Marcus, we're not meeting dailies, all right? Vendors are cutting us off. I don't have the money to fix it right this second, but I will get you a new mixer, okay? I promise you.
Carmen, yeah. Buzzer!
All right, that's the beef. Come on, give me a hand.
All right, Jamel, let me start with you. It's, as I said, you know, there's nothing unexpected about the setup, at least to my mind, but in the execution, maybe, made fresh. What do you think?
I really enjoyed it. I've watched three episodes so far, and I have enjoyed each and every one of them. I think the show, and I can be kind of a cheap date sometimes. I think the show got me immediately when its opening musical cue was the song New Noise by The Refused, a Swedish hardcore band that I really love. And I was sort of like, oh, okay, I'm dialed into what this show is trying to do immediately. And I have I've really enjoyed watching it thus far. It's sort of quickly paced, which makes sense for the setting. Quickly paced, lots of sort of like, you know, loving shots of food, but also sort of quick cutting between all the various people in the kitchen. And I think that that just sort of like hits some chemical zone in my brain that I enjoy.
Oh yeah.
And everything seems real. I don't know. The thing about it is that the environment seems, and the characters and the dilemmas, they seem real. You know, Carmine's cousin, I'm not sure what their familial relationship actually is, but his cousin, that seems like a real dude to me. Not someone I necessarily know, but like someone I could imagine. And the same goes for Sydney, played by Ayo Edebiri. She seems like a real person that I might actually know.
Yeah.
It also helps that I've watched three of the three episodes while like prepping lunch for my wife and myself. So it's sort of, I was just like in the right headspace too.
Yeah. Dana, you know, totally, you could argue stale setup, but authenticity and pace throughout, says Jamel. What do you think?
Yeah, the pace is, I think, the most remarkable thing about this show in a way, because it moves so quickly. And yet, as Jamel was saying, it gets a lot done in terms of establishing character. You know, these main characters that we mentioned who are all really well drawn, but also all the secondary characters in the kitchen. The pastry chef, an amazing character who starts to figure more largely later on in the season. Everybody is really deftly sketched, but the episodes almost feel too short. Some of them are only, I think, 20 minutes long. I mean, they really careen, you know, and the editing is kind of careening too, as you could hear in that clip. Sometimes that's a little bit too fast moving for the plot. I think this movie is stronger on characterization and on dialogue scene by scene than it is on wholly establishing exactly what's going on. I mean, there is no backstory to a lot of these characters to a degree that is refreshing, for one thing. I mean, it's not flashbacks every 2 minutes and over-explaining everything, but some things are almost sort of under-explained. Like this place, this restaurant that's apparently been going for generations, it belonged to the parents of the main character played by Jeremy Allen White, is this kind of old school sandwich place. I'm not familiar enough with Chicago food to know what establishments it's supposed to be based on or riffing on in some way, but it's not quite established exactly what it, you know, what kind of life did they have growing up with restaurateur parents. What were their parents like? What happened to their parents? I mean, apparently they're both dead, but we don't know how old the kids were or when that happened. There's these three siblings. I mean, I don't want to get into the whole background of it, but I could have used a little bit more flashback or exposition about exactly how we got to this point in the evolution of the restaurant, because it's so chaotic when we first join, you know, at this moment that the main character is coming to take over, that you're not quite aware why it was so successful for all this time or how it continued to function. maybe the next season will bring about some of that. I don't know about you guys, but I found this addictive enough that I watched all 8 episodes. I've seen all of The Bear, and my first feeling on, you know, the last frame of the Bear was, where's more Bear? I want more Bear.
Oh,
it's not a perfect show, but it's wildly addictive. In large part, we haven't really talked about it, but I think Jeremy Allen White, the kid who plays Carmi, the main character, is just fantastic. His face is wonderful. He's like, he's got a face and not just a look, but a kind of demeanor that's out of an old school. He's like somebody who would be in an old Scorsese movie almost, or Cassavetes. You know what I mean?
I was thinking an Altman movie. He seems like a, he seems a face out of an Altman movie.
Right. And the show kind of seems built around that in a way. I mean, there's it's not to the level of a great Altman movie, but it's got that overlapping dialogue and rapid editing and that slightly disjointed feeling of a Cassavetes or an Altman era production, and that's fresh feeling in itself on TV.
No, I'm totally with you. He's got that like Elliot Gould, Donald Sutherland, Dustin Hoffman era. Like, these guys are movie stars. It was shocking to the world that they could be, and of course they were, combined with like the Tom Cruise 1980s bod. You know, so it's like the 70s face, the 80s bod. He's captivating. The camera loves him. I love him. This show, you're right, Dana, addictive is exactly the right word. I can't get enough of it. I resent the shit out of the fact that I had to stop watching in order to make this podcast. Jamel, like you, I got through 3 episodes. I can't wait to blow through 4 through 8. It's quick in part because of like this in medias res, like, we're going to throw you into the kitchen. It's disorienting. It's fast-paced. It is always on the brink. And this is what it's like, and you feel that authenticity. But it also has these, first of all, tiny, beautifully observed details that are so quick you can miss them because it's like, keep up, keep up, keep up, pay attention.
For example, and this kind of gets to Dana's point about, but the lack of backstory, but also I think this wears well for the show. There's a scene, I think, in the second episode where Carmine's talking to his sister on the phone and she's making dinner. And there's the camera moves to show what she's making. She's making a chicken piccata and it looks beautiful. And you're like, that tells you so much about her and their family, right? Sort of like, all the kids get food.
Yeah.
Like, even if they're not in the business.
Yeah, exactly. And there's another one, Jamel, I'll give you. Really early on in episode 1, he's laying out the sides that he's going to serve that night, and they're just in little plastic to-go type containers, and he takes a little napkin and he does that thing that servers do at, like, you know, 11 Madison or Noma or whatever, where they just wipe the plate clean along the perimeter. He does it with the little, it's like a little Michelin touch in the middle of this joint, and it's just perfect. It just shows you who this guy is and what his standards have been. There's an Oliver Platt sighting. There's just not enough Oliver Platt in my life, and that scene with him is marvelous. That's a great character. The soundtrack, it goes everywhere, and as someone who hates Wilco, I was even like, god damn, like, that fucking song works there, right? And they picked the most transcendent, not only the most transcendent Van Morrison song, St. Dominic's Preview, but the transcendent live performance from the early 70s. It just, the pace and energy off the charts. Like, I know they're going to Mystic Pizza me here. I strongly suspect they're going to Mystic Pizza me here. I don't care. I want it to happen so badly.
I'm not sure what Mystic Pizza'd indicates. I saw that movie too many decades ago. What are you talking about?
The setup makes you think that the snobby food critic is going to come in the end and have a bite of the sandwich and like that look of revelatory joy on his face and on and everyone walks away happy. They're not going to do it, but that's how trite the setup is. But I just, whatever they do, I don't care. We should say, Jamel, also there's this shadow over the whole thing. I'm curious to hear how you rate its authenticity of the dead brother, Michael, who I thought they handled it well. It's just yet another element that can be sort of slapdashedly thrown in there for pathos and just seems lazy. It didn't strike me as lazy, but what do you think?
Yeah, it didn't strike me as lazy either. I think you actually get something that is very true about this show, which is that it does have a lot of seeming cliches, but I think it's executed at such a high level. I mean, not unlike the food in the show, right? Sort of like an Italian beef sandwich is not, you know, there's not that much to it. But, you know, executing it at a high level can make it something great. And likewise, this show does have quite a few cliches in it. But the show itself, executing its sort of vision at such a high level that you can kind of look past them, and it doesn't really bother you all that much. And the dead brother hovering over all that is another one of those cliches. And it doesn't, he's brought in actually quite sparingly. Again, only seen three episodes, but after the first episode, he's not there all that much. He's sort of like, you know, things happen, people talk, there are conversations that kind of like raise his specter again, but it's not as if there's like a picture of the guy in the kitchen looming over everyone.
There is a moment when we see him in a flashback, and I don't think this is revealing too much. The show is very light, possibly too light on flashbacks, and we only get to glimpse the brother briefly. The dead brother who handed his restaurant down to his little brother. But when you do, he's played by John Bernthal, which is a pretty big actor to get for such a small role. And it's such a smart move to get somebody like that, because if you picture John Bernthal's face, it also comes from that world, yeah. Right? I mean, it's very much from that kind of like new Hollywood world of a sort of mug, you know? And he seems very believable as this brother who would be so charismatic that he could hold this shambling restaurant together with just sheer force of personality.
Can I say just one thing on the point about sort of these faces looking like they're from the 70s? Actually, it's two things. The first is that I'm just a sucker for any media, any TV show or movie that is about people executing a craft, whether that's cooking, whether that's journalism, whether that's, you know, and this gets to to your point, Dana, about 70s New Hollywood. Whether that's being a really intense strip club owner. I'm thinking of The Killing of a Chinese Bookie, which is what this show kind of reminds me of in some ways. So it's sort of like the combination of those two things is just sort of like manna from heaven for me. I'm just like a happy camper watching it.
Oh, yeah. I thought about Cassavetes a lot watching it, but I didn't think specifically of Killing of a Chinese Bookie, and that's so perfect because it is also about a very shambling business, right? That's always on the verge of falling apart, but it's being run lovingly by this incredible craftsman. I do have a question, and maybe this goes out to Chicago listeners, but when I was watching this with my partner, we were confused by the nature of this restaurant. Like, it seemed somewhat incoherent that there would be this place that would have both these very kind of, you know, just working class beef sandwiches that seems to be, it's called the original beef of Chicagoland, right? It's just this very old school basic place. But then they also have a pastry chef who's crafting these incredible chocolate cakes with orange zest on top. And there seem to be these fancy things going on in the corner. And this is separate from the fact that, you know, this 4-star Michelin chef is coming in to run the place. We're talking about like the extant menu on this beloved Chicago institution just seems to be strangely unbalanced. And I kind of can't imagine what place it's supposed to be modeled after. So if anybody knows a place like that, tell me both so I can relieve my my curiosity and so I can go eat there next time I'm in Chicago.
Yeah.
So I'm obviously not a Chicago person, but I mean, that does remind me of, you know, there's a beloved local place in Charlottesville that closed down, you know, it's been years now. But it was the kind of, you know, it was both sort of like a meet and three, but also they would occasionally do sort of like, you know, fancy stuff. And then they would also do great pastries. And it kind of just like, it was a little bit of everything. And that might actually explain why it went under.
Right. Like nobody knew who ate there. And I guess that's part of the story of this show, is that they're sort of trying to redefine what the restaurant is. But it is supposed to be this ongoing institution that people line up outside every day for these sandwiches. And I kind of wished at the beginning there had been a little bit more of an establishing of like, here's what the menu is now, so that we know when Carmi comes in and starts to change it, what those changes mean.
Okay, well, three really enthusiastic thumbs up, and I'd love to hear from Chicagoans about the authenticity of the show and like place for us in the culinary landscape, this restaurant. Anyway, it's The Bear. It's on Hulu. Check it out. We all loved it. Moving on.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Hey, listeners, whether you love true crime or comedies, celebrity interviews, news, or even motivational speakers, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance, too. Enter the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. The Name Your Price tool puts you in charge of your auto insurance by working just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance. Then they'll show you a variety of coverages that fit within your budget, giving you options. Now, that's something you'll want to press play on. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to choose the best option for you fast. It's just one of the many ways you can save with Progressive Insurance. Quote today at progressive.com to try the Name Your Price tool for yourself and join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
All right. Well, there's a video called Easiest Dinner Hack Ever! ! Many exclamation points. It's earned, I guess is the word, 42 million views. It's basically a home cook, seems like maybe a suburban mom. I don't know. She makes what effectively amounts to a Chef Boyardee slop pie. She starts with a couple of cans of Chef Boyardee, some pre-shredded mozzarella, pre-packed, pre-shredded mozzarella, a store-bought pie crust already in the tin, and then she takes some. She begins mixing those together, and then the pièce de résistance here. She lays out some Wonder Bread, slathers it in butter, and then she just powders it in garlic powder, and then she presses her. I'm sure I didn't dream this. I'm pretty sure I didn't dream this. She just presses her forearms down on this Wonder Bread.
You just kind of flatten them out like this. Perfect. Really get that powder in there. Awesome.
Before stacking it and cutting off the crust, because as she assures us,
no child wants to eat crust.
Pops it all in the oven, and out comes this, what to even call it, but of course social media went crazy for this, inspired all kinds of derision. Jamil, I'm going to start with you. You are a man of many, many parts. Two of them are cooking and being the one genuinely likable man on social media, and you bring the two together quite well. We found your anti-self here. What on earth is going on here? What did you make of this trend of disgusting food videos garnering billions and billions of views?
So I have a TikTok. And one of the things I do on my TikTok is you can do this thing called duetting where it shows one video on one side of the screen and then you kind of can comment on it. And so I've taken this sort of doing that with some of these food videos because they are really quite baffling. And it's hard sometimes to know which ones are like a bit, you know, like someone actually doing something terrible to food for like, you know, to become viral. And which ones are someone sincerely making something that they think is great and is actually sort of kind of terrible. And I think for viewers, there's sort of like the same, you know, fascination and disgust that comes with watching any kind of horrific thing happening, like watching a popular genre of video on YouTube is like, you know, someone like popping pimples, right? And sort of those sorts of things. And I think it's the same kind of urge. It's sort of like, this is terrible and looks horrible and you kind of can't turn away. But a huge portion of TikTok and similar social media is people making bad food and people watching other people make bad food. And I couldn't fully explain to you what is so appealing about it, but it is in a weird way very appealing. I'm thinking of one I watched of someone making a pasta dish that was just sort of like bland. And sort of had like, you know, pasta and cheese and like, you know, gray looking chicken and all sorts of things thrown in that just was like, why would you? And it seemed like sincere. It didn't seem like a joke. It seemed like, this is good eating to me. And it's sort of like, I don't understand anything about this dish or like anything about your taste buds. Like, it doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah. Dana puts his finger on something I hadn't quite thought of, but it's this whopping discrepancy between, listen, whatever you get up to in the intimacy of your own kitchen to satisfy your appetite within reason is cool. It's like, that's the, you know, your prerogative, but to then be proud of it in this way and platform it to the entire universe. It's that's what you're watching more than the making of, like, you know, fish in a coffee maker. You know, it's you're watching someone's apparent total lack of self-awareness or like Warholian capacity for irony so deep and pervasive, there's no discrepancy between sincerity and inauthenticity anymore. I don't know. Anyway, that I'm blabbing because I'm mystified, basically. Sort me out.
I mean, I think that distinction is actually important. It's crucial whether these things are being sincerely shared as somebody's cooking tip that they enjoy in the privacy of their own home, or whether they're just perverse trolling, trying to gross people out and get views. That's a hugely important distinction that to me goes from giving it some degree of fascination, although personally, I would never watch someone popping a pimple on a video. And these just grossed me out so much I could hardly watch them for the purposes of research. But especially if, as seems to be the case with most of these, like the SpaghettiO pie lady, if these people are just trolling and all they're trying to do is, you know, gross people out with stuff that they would never eat in their lives, then I don't know. I just feel pranked and bored by the whole phenomenon. Like, it's very, very different if, you know, if we're exchanging food lore and food culture and then sort of like being horrified and or mocking each other's food cultures. It's something entirely different if someone is just, as one of these things was, I think, like baking something in a bed of nerd candies, you know, so as to get likes or get shares. And then when this person is asked, like, do you actually eat your creations, they say, I'm just an entertainer, you know, as some of these food bloggers do. I don't know. I mean, to me, that distinction between am I being trolled or am I witnessing someone's actual cooking life is a really crucial one in terms of whether I want to watch or I just feel annoyed by the whole phenomenon. And then I was thinking, Jamel, about your cereal videos. I mean, in a way, you're a practitioner of this art, but I respect your practice of it more when you have your cereal eats, right? What's it called? Your
Yeah, it's called Cereal Eats, yeah.
Yeah, which we've talked about on this show. I think we did a Slate Plus segment about it. And watching you plow your way through various horrifying breakfast foods is fun watching to me, because it feels like, well, for one thing, you're really eating them, right? You're not just trying to gross people out with a visual and then throwing the whole thing away when the camera is off. And I don't know, it feels like you as an eater and as a cook are exploring a world of food that is horrifying yet fascinating to you. If that was what were happening in these videos, I would find them more fun and watchable. But I don't know, just the cynicism of like, look how gross I can be, and then you share it seems really annoying to me. I'm not on TikTok, but these often get autoplayed into my Twitter feed if there's one that goes really viral. And suddenly, without having ever asked for it, I'm seeing somebody put, you know, a dozen eggs into a giant bowl of melted Velveeta or something like that. And I just find it annoying.
So two things. One, I think there's a guy on TikTok who I think you would actually like, and he is some sort of like home cook baker guy, but he cooks recipes from like mid-century to early 20th century. And so it's just interesting to watch him make these things, because it's usually baked goods, and he really does focus on sort of Depression era. And so it's sort of fun to see what actually turns out pretty well and then what is actually sort of horrifying. And you're kind of getting a glimpse of what may have been kitchen staples for Americans during this period. So he's actually good to watch, and it's a good combination of like genuinely informative, but also like, oh, this is kind of gross, and that's fun too. The other thing is that I think having watched too many cooking videos on TikTok, some of which are obviously trolling, some of which are just people making food and like displaying it for the world to see, and they think the food is good or whatever. Some of it's sort of like, you know, here's an easy thing you can make for your family that always ends up being sort of like chicken breasts and like cream cheese and like, you know, salsa in a crock pot. Part of what this has revealed to me is just how like I'm obsessed with food. I love cooking. It's like one of my favorite activities. I spend a lot of time thinking about it and thinking about the meals that I'm going to prepare for the family and for myself. And it's sort of a glimpse into the world of, I think, many Americans, even most Americans, who like just don't care that much. And not in a bad way, just like don't have the time, don't have the interest, and just sort of like are just trying to like consume food, like trying to like, you know, sate themselves. And will enjoy something nice that's made for them, but they're not going to go out of their way to do it for themselves. And I think in a weird way, I found it almost sort of useful in terms of sort of like thinking about how a typical person might experience food or experience restaurants or whatever, versus an admittedly like crazy person like myself. And it's sort of a thing that you can translate to like other mediums. Like it's useful, to know that maybe the person encountering your column isn't necessarily going to be someone who religiously consumes political media, but may, just only occasionally consume it. Doesn't really care that much about it. And you sort of have to keep that person in mind. And if, I feel like if I were running a restaurant, like, watching these videos would actually be kind of useful for the same reason, sort of like what is the typical person? How does the typical person interact with and experience food? And it's more like, the bad pasta than it is I mentioned earlier that I watched some of The Bear while making lunch for my wife and myself. It's less like my kind of grain bowl with farro and Brussels sprouts and the vinaigrette or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, picking up on that directly, it reminded me, Jamel, also of all the millions or billions, really billions of at-home hobbyist musicians who upload their cover of, Time After Time or whatever. And it's such a wide range, and it has a true beauty to it, both when someone absolutely nails it and at the beginning of the video you think, how is this person, right? And of course we're so conditioned by pop stardom to think of people who can actually play and sing beautifully as looking a certain way, which of course totally artificial connection, and the most unexpected people do the most genuinely accomplished and very beautiful covers. At the same time, people mangle it completely or sing consistently a half note off, or, they're just awful. And what you think at that moment is, to me, what I take away isn't some sick Schadenfreude. Instead, it's like that person wants to make music for themselves, right? They don't want to just be a passive consumer of it. And sure, there's some amusing, lack of self-awareness there. That's a cheap present to give oneself as the viewer. Instead, it's like the larger principle that I extrapolate from it is one I truly believe in as a shitty at-home musician, which is like, I just have to make my own music. I don't care how bad it is. I will try not to force it on others, but I love it too much not to try to make it myself. And at that moment, I understand why Bob Dylan's, nasal twang and three chords conduces to a kind of transcendence, and why mine doesn't, let's just say. But it's Dana, I'll pivot it back to food a little bit by saying, Betty Crocker didn't take off until they realized if you allowed the homemaker to add an egg, then all of a sudden, and it was very gendered, she would feel as though she was still cooking the family meal and not just opening a package. And there's that element of it too. It's like we surrounded by this consumer culture of absurd plenty in which everything is pre-made for us, and even our own experience of it seems to come prepackaged in some sense. And that this is I think kind of weirdly heroic way of fighting back against that and saying, actually the abiding human principle here is creativity, selfhood via creativity. Fuck you, I'm going to do it regardless of how laughable it might be to others.
I guess. I mean, once again, you're imputing a lot of sincerity to these videos. I still don't hear either of you responding to just like somebody deliberately trolling you by baking potatoes within a bed of nerds. I mean, that is not true. Somebody expressing their inner creativity.
Yeah, but Dana, after all these years, though, don't you know that I'm the soulful innocent entrapped in the basement of consumer culture? Or at least that's how I conceive it. That's my laughable lack of self-awareness, that I think I'm that person. Please.
I mean, I'm just going to send our listeners to Jamel's Cereal Eats. Like, if you want gross food done right, that's the place to go.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there. It was fun. But oh, man, these videos, just crazy. Check them out. If someone has a theory about the ratio of prankishness to touching sincerity, we'd love to hear it. Shoot us an email. All right. Moving on.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
All right, now is the moment in our podcast when we endorse Dana. What do you have this week?
I am actually bursting with things to endorse this week, but I will keep it to one, although the one has sort of two prongs. So Peter Brook, the legendary theater director, died last week at 97. He had been around for an incredibly long time. I don't know about you guys, but I feel like from as early as I remember what theater was, I would always hear about, oh, Peter Brook is directing this, Peter Brook is directing that. I myself have never seen a production directed by him, but it seemed like I was always just coming up against one, hearing about one, being in a town where some legendary show had just closed. And he did everything from, you know, Shakespeare to opera to, famously, he did a version for the BBC of the Mahabharata, the Hindu epic. And he was a really revolutionary theater director in ways that I probably can't really speak to as a non-theater scholar. I mean, our beloved Isaac Butler would be great to hear on this. But I did some digging into Peter Brook over the weekend. And in addition to reading a couple great obits on him, I ended up coming across this documentary called Brook by Brook, An Intimate Portrait. And it's just an hour-long interview with Peter Brook done in 2001, so 20 years ago, but he was already an older man because he died at 97. And he's just looking back on a life of directing and talking about theater and what it means to him. He's fantastically well-spoken. It really makes you want to dig more into his work. And then after that, you can go on a big YouTube dive and see a lot of things, including a complete Hamlet that he directed in 2002 with Adrian Lester is Hamlet, that, at least to go by the comments on this video, is, you know, one of the great Hamlets ever. So, and it's a version of the play, I believe, that was cut down, edited, and sort of recast by Brook himself. So go on a Peter Brook deep dive is my main endorsement. But you can start with Brook by Brook, An Intimate Portrait, the 1 hour documentary, and the Adrian Lester as Hamlet performance, both on YouTube in their entirety.
Yeah, fabulous, Dana. I'm with you. I heard that name from my adolescence on repeatedly. This god of theater, I know so embarrassingly little about him. I can't wait to watch it. Jamel, what do you have?
So currently on Criterion Channel, there is a series to do with a program series. It's one of the great things about the app, about the service. And one of them is called In the Ring, Boxing on Screen. And it's 16 films, some of which you've probably heard of, Raging Bull, When We Were Kings, Rocco and His Brothers. But one I had never heard of and recently watched and was utterly delighted by it. And the film is called Gentleman Jim. It's directed by Raoul Walsh, and it stars Errol Flynn. It's from 1942, and it's about this, you know, working class Irish bank teller who aspires to be a gentleman and is also a talented boxer and becomes the heavyweight champion of the world. And he doesn't really experience real setbacks. There's like very little friction. It's sort of like, it's a pretty effortless glide from sort of bottom to top, and yet, despite the lack of, you might say, dramatic tension, it is an utterly delightful film. Errol Flynn is so charming and so fun to watch. He's obviously very athletic, and he apparently trained quite a bit for the role. And so much of the boxing on screen is just him in the ring. And I don't know much of Raoul Walsh's work, but the boxing is so dynamic. And boxing, I think, is a very cinematic sport to begin with. Two people in a ring, it's sort of hard not to make it dynamic. But this was like the first fight in the film. I was like riveted. It's like a very like dynamic and fun to watch fight. And yeah, it's just like, it's a great movie. And yeah, so Gentleman Jim on the Criterion Channel. Highly, highly recommend it.
I cannot wait. That sounds very cool. Dana, off the top of your head, Raoul Walsh, am I blanking? Is there a big one? I feel like there might be.
I just like opened up his page on Letterboxd, and I feel like a dummy now because he directed White Heat and High Sierra and They Drive By Night.
High Sierra, that's what I was thinking of. Yeah. Yeah, he's known as a Western guy.
All right, I'm going to endorse a kind of involving read that I can't recommend highly enough. It's an essay by Timothy Snyder, the historian, Yale historian, who's come to only greater prominence, it seems, with every passing year, in part because he's, you know, he wrote Bloodlands, in some ways the definitive book on the Ukraine crisis from the World War II era, which involved the Ukraine being a plaything between the Nazis and the Stalinists, between Russia and Germany, resulting in just an absolute bloodbath. He was even, you know, I mean, it's just the rise of Trump. He became a voice of sort of sober, you know, defense of the essential values of liberalism, and it had a huge bestseller in On Tyranny. You're probably familiar with him. Anyway, he has written a long, extensive, beautifully calm, and to my mind, exquisitely argued rejoinder to one of my heroes, Jürgen Habermas, the German philosopher who's, I think, widely regarded as the living embodiment of the Enlightenment, the one remaining, I guess, living embodiment of the European Enlightenment. And Habermas, not to get esoteric, but the reason why Snyder felt compelled to issue a public rebuke to Habermas isn't because he doesn't admire him. It's because, you know, Habermas's central commitment is to the idea of rational communicators coming together, and that the essence of Enlightenment truth is through a kind of extended conversation between negotiators. And, you know, Snyder has effectively said this is the German disease vis-a-vis Ukraine in a nutshell, this idea that endless suasion and talk and nuancing actually becomes, it actually becomes a contribution to the malevolent side in a certain kind of conflict, i.e. a conflict that cannot be described in the traditional terms of liberalism between mutually respectful opponents. Of course, Putin isn't that. He's not part of a reasoned dialogue at all. He's a brutalist, currently attempting to effectively enslave another autonomous country. And Snyder just very carefully lays out why this is a total failure of thought to approach this conflict in this way, and how it's representative, sadly, of German elites. But I would recommend it for another reason as well, which is that oddly, for all of its total dismantling of Habermas's reasoning and his history, it's also, in a way, it honors the master in some sense, because it itself is such a perfect example of communicative rationality. It contains no insults. There's nothing ad hominem about it. It's devoted. It's not a performance meant to show you what a genius Timothy Snyder is. It's not an attempt to dunk on someone or publicly humiliate them. It's an attempt to reason one's way in dialogue with someone else you disagree with, perhaps vehemently, toward a possible common truth, and at the same time honoring the agency and the political dignity of the Ukrainians. I think it's a masterful performance. And I say this as someone who, in some ways, I mean, with huge qualifications, but in some ways, you know, worships what Habermas's lifelong project has been. Anyway, the piece is "Germans Have Been Involved in the War Chiefly on the Wrong Side" by Timothy Snyder. And we will post a link to it on our show page. Jamel, thank you so much for coming on the show. As always, just an absolute pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, it is always my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. And Dana, week after week, an awesome pleasure talking to you too. Really
yes,
fun.
Yes. I wish you an unwon farewell.
There you go. You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page. That's slate.com/culturefest. And you can email us at culturefest@slate.com. Our introductory music is by the composer Nick Britell. Our producer is Cameron Drews. Our production assistant is Nadira Goff. For Jamel Bowie and Dana Stevens, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll see you soon.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere. This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.